Hi, I'm Mark Webber, and this is Keeping Track.
You're listening to Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian Grand Prix.
In this week's episode, we look back at all of the action from the flyaway races to open the 2012 season. Journalist Will Buxton discusses Formula One's controversial visit to Bahrain, and Red Bull Racing team principal Christian Horner joins us to talk about his team's start to the year. There's all that and more on Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian Grand Prix.
Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian Grand Prix. I'm Matt Clayton, and thanks again for your company. We're now four rounds into what's shaping up as a fascinating Formula One season. And later on, we'll speak to Red Bull Racing's team principal Christian Horner about the start of the year for his team and drivers Sebastian Vettel and Mark Webber. We'll also chat to Speed Channel's pit lane reporter Will Buxton, who offers a unique perspective on the Bahrain Grand Prix. For the time being, let's quickly recap the results of the first three races since the season opening Australian Grand Prix. Malaysia was round two, and we saw a superb victory by Ferrari's Fernando Alonso, who mastered the tricky conditions at Sepang to record a most unlikely win after Ferrari's struggles to start the year. Sauber's Sergio Perez was the other star of the show, the young Mexican finishing second for his maiden Formula One podium, while McLaren's Lewis Hamilton was third after starting from pole, as he'd done in Melbourne. Fast forward to China, and we had a new Formula One winner in the form of Nico Rosberg of Mercedes, who took his first victory in his 111th Grand Prix start. Joining Rosberg on the podium were McLaren duo Jenson Button and Lewis Hamilton, while Mark Webber was fourth for the third successive race for Red Bull. Bahrain was a week after China, and we had Sebastian Vettel, the familiar sight of the Red Bull world champion, atop the podium with his first win of 2012. Behind the reigning world champion were Lotus pair Kimi Raikkonen, the first podium of Raikkonen's comeback season, and Romain Grosjean, who took the first podium of his Formula One career. Mark Webber was, you guessed it, fourth for the fourth race in succession this year and sixth in the last seven dating back to 2011. So after four rounds, Vettel leads the Drivers' Championship with 53 points, four ahead of Lewis Hamilton in second and just 5 points ahead of Webber in third, while in the Constructors, Red Bull, 102 points, leads the way, McLaren second with 92, and the fantastic weekend in Bahrain for Lotus sees them in third with 57 points. So that's where the championship stands after the opening quartet of races. Four races won by four drivers in four different cars. To discuss that and the stories behind the opening four races of the season, Stuart Sykes joined me on the phone after Bahrain, and I began by asking him how he could make sense of the opening four races of the Formula One season.
Well, I think only one thing is certain, Matt, and it goes back to something that Jenson Button said just after he had won the season's opening race right here in Melbourne. He said, and I quote, "F1's in a great place right now." I firmly believe that it is in terms of what's happening on track. The four races so far have shown that he is absolutely right. Four races, four winners, Button himself, Alonso, surprisingly perhaps, Rosberg, first time, and Vettel, much less surprisingly. More importantly, we've had four terrific races with action all the way through the field. It's not just up at the front that things are happening. There's midfield battles, there's tail-end battles. And I think also we've learned that the regulations notwithstanding, it is what you might call an engine formula. And despite Fernando Alonso's Malaysian heroic for the Ferrari engine, it's kind of Mercedes v. Renault this season. I don't know whether that chimes in with your own thinking. Mercedes supply three teams, including their own, of course. Renault supply four. Mercedes won the AGP. It was a Mercedes engine that won it. The Shanghai race was a Mercedes 1-2-3, but then Renault have bounced back, and in Bahrain it was a Renault 1-2-3-4, so I think that's going to be a fantastic battle all season long, and if Ferrari can chip in, so much the better. And yet, we go home to Europe, as it were, with Red Bull still in their customary position, 9 points ahead of McLaren, Vettel P1, Webber P3 in the driver's standing. So, plus ça change, as they say in French, and the more things change, the more they stay the same.
It's interesting, Stuart. You mentioned that with Red Bull. I think if we'd seen Red Bull 1 and 4 and Lotus, because they were particularly good in pre-season testing as well, I'm not sure we would be that surprised after Bahrain, but it's what's happened before Bahrain that I think makes it a little bit more confusing. And part of that, we have to touch on this, Nico Rosberg, first career win, 111th start, and terrific to see him and Mercedes on the top of that podium in China.
Absolutely. I think all new winners are good for the sport. There's been over 100 of them. Now I lie awake at night trying to remember who the 100 of them are. But It was good for Rosberg. He's been around a long time. As you said, his 111th race, curiously, 111 years after the first official Mercedes win in a non-championship event, of course, in France all those years ago, and 30 years after his famous father, Keke, won his Formula One World Championship. Rosberg's been knocking on the door for a long while. He started out with the fastest lap in Bahrain, of all places. Coincidentally, he is the eighth driver to win a Grand Prix in a works Mercedes, but only the third in a World Championship Grand Prix. And when you consider that the other two were called Fangio and Moss, that's fairly exalted company that Nico is keeping. It was also the first Mercedes works pole position and the first Mercedes works pole P1 in a race since Italy in 1955, September the 11th, when Fangio did it. So it was a wonderfully resonant historical moment and a historic moment for Mercedes and for Rosberg himself. Couldn't quite back it up at the weekend, got himself in a bit of trouble, and I think he was lucky to get away with what happened in Bahrain. But yes, it's been wonderful to see Mercedes up there, but what's happened to Michael?
Well, he's certainly had a bit of bad luck, Michael, that's for sure. But, Stuart, we're talking Nico Rosberg. Of course, his first Formula One teammate was Mark Webber at Williams back in 05. How have you seen Mark's season so far? I mean, the obvious word would be consistent, I suppose, with four fourth-place finishes. But what do you make of his start to the season and also his compatriot Daniel Ricciardo, who's had some ups and downs, terrific qualifying in Bahrain and perhaps not so good on that first lap there?
No, I think that showed perhaps a wee bit of shaken confidence from Dan. I think he had a wonderful start to the season. And just to reiterate what we said back then, I think a lot of the feel-good buzz around Albert Park was due to young Dan Ricciardo. He's qualified as your 10th, 15th, 17th, and then a brilliant 6th, and then raced 9th, 12th, 17th, and 15th. 4-0 against Jev, Jean-Éric Vergne, in qualifying, but 3-1 down to him in terms of race finishes. So there's a bit of work to do for team and driver there, I think, and Dan hasn't got the automatic huge smile that has become his trademark, but I'm sure it'll be back there soon. As for Mark, 10 in a row in the top four straight P4s here. It was nice that he started the season 3-0 against Vettel in qualifying. Of course, when Vettel does get one over on him, Vettel lands up on pole position, unlike Mark. Let's hope that Mark hasn't gone to a sort of process of natural selection, or in modern terminology, a default position of P4, i.e. the first man outside the very top three. He needs a podium soon, and even better, he needs a victory soon. But he said himself he's had a strong opening segment of the season and he's very happy, I think, like all of them, to be going back to Europe.
Well, I think it's night and day comparing the start of Mark's season in 2011 to this year. He certainly looks much more on top of things. Stuart, one team that isn't on top of things, Ferrari. They've had a pretty wretched start to this year, despite that quite remarkable win by Fernando Alonso in Malaysia. Fernando really outperforming the car at the moment, and probably a truer indication of where that car sits is the performance of Felipe Massa. He was the last driver in the field, other than the six drivers that turn out for the three, inverted commas, new teams, to score a point in 2012, which is extraordinary to think. Where do you see Ferrari at the moment?
Well, just to think about Bahrain for a moment, if you had been a very careful observer, in Bahrain, land of the camel, you'd have spotted another creature with a humped back. That was Fernando Alonso, because he's been carrying that wretched F2012 all year. And was Malaysia a one-off thanks to Alonso? I think it probably was. As for Massa, feisty in Bahrain, but he had to be, as you rightly point out, after his dismal start. And as he said, yeah, he's got points, but it is not Ferrari's style to be happy with ninth place. And you can rest assured that a certain Mr. De Montezemolo is not happy at all with what's going on there. As for what is going on, I think it's time for Ferrari to have what Pat Fry, the leading engineer, the technical person there now, calls a radical rethink. It's time for a close look, not just at the way they build the cars, but at the team's entire modus operandi. And I think with people of the caliber of Fry doing it, then we will see changes soon. But the question is how long Fernando will be patient with him. He is, of course, committed for the very long term. And I'm sure that he, the eternal optimist, feels that Ferrari will get back on track soon. Massa's pressure, of course, increased with that wonderful performance by Perez in a similarly engined Sauber back in round two, when he pushed Fernando all the way to that unlikely Ferrari victory. Just in case people, by the way, are not aware, and a lot of people won't be, there was a legitimate reason for some sense of distraction in the Ferrari camp over the weekend. They were all grieving for a gearbox specialist of theirs called Matteo Vignali, who died of a heart attack, and the man was only 32, so there were off-track reasons for a bit of lack of focus, perhaps. But again, yet, Fernando heads back to Europe and he's only 10 points behind. How does that happen with a car which is clearly a bit of a dog? And he himself has said it's a bit like a present. And if he can take advantage of this test that's coming up and then get themselves together in the next 3 weeks ahead of Europe, who knows what Ferrari can do.
Well, Stuart, you mentioned going back to Europe. Of course, we've got Barcelona as the first of the European rounds coming up in 3 weeks' time. Before that, of course, we have an in-season test. We haven't had one of these for quite a while. We're going to Mugello. Wouldn't it be terrific if there was a Grand Prix at Mugello, by the way? But how do you see that? Because Barcelona is a track where they pound around endlessly in pre-season testing. It's sort of become the new Hungaroring as far as non-eventful races through the season. But based on what we've had so far this year, perhaps we'll get a good race at Barcelona for a change.
I think so. I think you're spot on. I think every driver is heartily sick of going round and round there, knows it better than the ceiling of his own bedroom. But I think also in this season, even Barcelona might throw up a surprise or two. I think Ferrari will go all out to give F. Alonso of Spain all the help that he can get from the Scarlet car. I think that long straight in front of the main grandstand will also be interesting. We've had different reactions from DRS zones this year, some not so good, some excellent. Now let's see what happens in Barcelona. I think, too, that the Mugello test is probably a good thing and that it will give the teams, after four flyaway races in the space of 5 weeks, a bit of a chance to get back to their normal modus operandi and their normal surroundings and start to make major changes to the cars, which they've only been able to tweak since Melbourne.
Well, Stuart, there's a lot of terrific Grand Prix coming up, particularly, you know, Barcelona's always terrific, Monaco coming up as well. Look forward to discussing them with you a bit down the track. Thanks for joining us.
Good stuff. Thank you.
Don't forget to like the Australian Grand Prix on Facebook for behind-the-scenes news, updates and exclusive opportunities.
This is Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian GP.
After much deliberation, the Bahrain Grand Prix went ahead after the race was cancelled in 2011 because of political and social unrest in the region. One man uniquely placed a comment on Bahrain is Speed Channel's Will Buxton, who was there in 2011 for the GP2 event that had to be canned, and was also there for the fourth race of this Formula One season. Will, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, mate. You were one of the people who were there last year, of course, when GP2 had to abandon that weekend then, and then you went back again this year. How was it there over the F1 weekend this year in terms of atmosphere, and how did it compare to what you experienced there in 2011? Because it was a fairly fraught time for you there 12 months ago.
Yeah, it was. 12 months ago, we were caught in the middle of the original February risings when the government decided, in their ultimate wisdom, to roll the tanks in. So Bahrain this year actually felt a lot more calm, and the security presence felt a lot lighter, mainly because the motorway wasn't lined with tanks, it was lined with police cars. So from that perspective, certainly for me, it felt a lot calmer and fairly normal. Manama itself was pretty quiet. There was obviously the police presence on the motorway, but other than that, I saw nothing over my time there that was any different to what I'd normally seen. But then again, that's why I guess they wanted the race to happen, was to show the world that things are normal out there, whether it is normal or not, because every night I return to the hotel, you turn on CNN or whatever news channel, and there are the reports of 50,000, 100,000 people protesting in Bahrain. And we never saw a single thing of that the entire time we were there. So two very different sides to the country, one of which we were shown, one of which we weren't. But I don't think in 4 days you can ever truly get a 100% accurate understanding of the politics of any country, particularly not one so divided.
You're always a bloke, Will, who tries to get out and see a little bit of the places where the Formula One circus tends to go to. Did you, make an effort to keep a bit of a lower profile last weekend? I mean, I know there were some of your colleagues that were out having a look at things and reporting on things they're not used to, but what about yourself? Did you go out and have a look at things, or did you try and sort of keep it fairly quiet?
I did, to be honest. Some people may say I was, sticking my head in the sand by not going and doing that, but ultimately I was there to report on a motor race. Some of my colleagues were tasked with going to find the bigger picture and try to get their teeth into the political situation out there, and were, asked to become foreign affairs correspondents. But, just as I wouldn't expect Kate Aidy to have a full understanding of why McLaren didn't quite get the tyres to work for them in Bahrain, so I don't think I'd have a full understanding, really, of the politics of the situation out there. it's such a tough one. Fumbling along between a rock and a hard place going out there. You know, we're going, damned if we didn't, damned if we didn't. It was always going to be politicized. But from the people that I met out there, you know, be they taxi drivers or the waiters or whoever that we had in our hotels, you know, they were all happy that the race was going on out there. Now, these aren't rich, landed, you know, members of the elite. These are just normal folks. And they were all pretty much to a man happy that the race was happening. And that's, you know, you look at the amount of exposure that even the opposition in Bahrain has had over the last week because the race was there. And perhaps you can say the race might have done some good because their voice, you know, the oppression of them, the repression of them, the argument that they wanted to get out to the world, they've been able to do without having to take sort of extreme measures in disrupting the race. So, you know, that their message has, I think, got out far stronger than it has over the last 12 months.
Two-part question for you, mate. A, do you think the race should have gone ahead? And B, has your opinion on that changed since you've been? From this time last week, you're obviously thinking about heading over. Since you've been and come back, has your opinion on that particular subject changed?
Do I think it should have gone ahead? Ultimately, I think that's a question that Formula One itself has to look at over the next week or so. I think Bernie, I think the FIA, the race organisers, they all need to sit down and have a long, hard look as to whether this was right or not. Because I don't think anyone's come out of this showered in much glory. The sport has looked uncaring and out of touch with you know, the political strife in a country. The Bahrainis have looked to have dug their heels in and not really given a hoot about their people. Just, you know, they wanted to you know, hold a race which is seen as a folly of the Crown Prince. So I think everyone needs to sit down and have a long, hard look at whether the race should have gone ahead. Ultimately, you know, you will ask the question, though, there are so many races now which are government-funded. Surely every single one of them is used for a political end, for a political purpose, to show the country in the best possible light, to increase tourism, to increase trade with that country. I don't think there is such a thing anymore as an unpolitical Grand Prix. That's just the nature of the beast, the nature of the amount of money that revolves around every Grand Prix. It can't not be political, certainly the ones that are government funded. So is going to Bahrain any different than going to China? Is it any different than going to Abu Dhabi? You know, these races which have so much government funding. Ultimately, that's, you know, it's a very difficult question to answer. But I think quite a few races now, you know, we race in those places for political ends. And I've sort of forgot what the second part of the question was, mate. Sorry,
Matt. The first part of the question was spectacularly answered. I don't think we'll bother with the second part. But I did want to ask
I did want to ask you
before you left, though. It would be remiss of me not to mention Nico Rosberg because of your long involvement with GP2, the very early days of that series. He's obviously the first GP2 champion. To see him finally come through after a lot of years of promise to win that first Grand Prix in China, that must have been actually something quite special for you and your own motorsport history, I suppose.
Oh, massively. I've got a framed shirt upstairs from Nico's year in GP2 in 05 that sort of arrived on my doorstep a couple of months after the end of that 05 season, and that sort of has pride of place in my house. And delighted to see Nico win. Start of the season, you know, the Mercedes had looked good, but Nico wasn't quite on it, and there were a couple of times in the first few races when Nico had been in a battle for position, and he just sort of folded over, you know, and I ended up sitting there thinking, I wonder if Nico's ever going to win a race. And it's the first time I started to think about it, that maybe Nico didn't have the fight in him. And then suddenly he gets a race win. And then in Bahrain, you saw how vehemently he defended his position. Mm-hmm. And suddenly Nico's got the fight back in him, you know? Mm-hmm. He's got the pace, and suddenly he's got that fight back. And everyone always says, you know, winning the first race is the hard part. But in the second race, is almost so much, always so much easier. And I think now Nico has crossed that boundary. He's got that first race win under him. We may start to see the Nico Rosberg that's been bubbling under the surface and trying to break out for all these years. That lad who would let a race win go, who would let a position go. I hope that's gone. And the real racy champion Nico that I remember from 05. Well, hopefully that's the Nico we're going to see.
Well, look, for the sake of the championship, Will, I'm sure you and plenty of others are hoping that's the case. Look, thanks very much for joining us, and particularly appreciate your insight on Bahrain, mate. Very much appreciated. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you.
Don't forget, you can follow the Australian Grand Prix on Twitter at Oz Grand Prix.
This is Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian GP.
Red Bull Racing has swept all before it in the last two seasons, with Sebastian Vettel winning back-to-back drivers' titles and the team doing likewise in the Constructors' Championship. Christian Horner is Red Bull Racing's team principal, and he's on the line to discuss the start of the 2012 season. Christian, thanks for joining us on Keeping Track.
It's a pleasure.
Christian, you've just come back from the first mid-season Formula One test for 4 years at Mugello. How did that go? And as a second question, is there much you can get out of a test at a track such as Mugello, such a fast-flowing, free-flowing circuit, that's going to help you for the races coming up? Because we have Monaco coming up, Valencia, very, very different type circuits. Is there much you can glean out of Mugello?
I think Mugello is a great track. I mean, it's in a lovely location. It's a fast-flowing circuit that the drivers, for sure, you know, both really enjoy driving around. But, you know, obviously, when you get given the chance to run these cars, the engineers jump at it with, you know, both feet. And I think that, you know, you can always learn. In Formula One, you can't stop learning. So we ran a few different setups, a few different components down there, which proved to be useful. I think the bigger question is you know, an in-season test where we do three times the mileage of a Grand Prix, is it the right thing for Formula One? Is it something that, you know, we need a bit more discussion about? Because when you're talking of cost saving, I don't think any team that attended that test actually saved any money.
Christian, what are your thoughts on the way MotoGP do their tests? As you're probably aware, they stay on and do something on the Monday after a Grand Prix at a circuit where everything and everybody is set up. Do you think there's some merit in that if the mid-season test is going to continue?
I think something like that possibly makes more sense. I mean, 3 or 4 years ago, we in the height of the crisis, financial crisis, the teams moved to abolish in-season testing and disbanded their test teams. And obviously, with 20 races on the calendar now, it's a pretty grueling schedule for, you know, all the mechanics and technicians and engineers, you know, involved. So I think that it's something we need to have a good look at, you know, moving forward. It was great to run at Mugello. Probably would have preferred to have done a race there than a test, but you know, that's the way it was agreed for this year. But you can always learn, you can always improve.
Christian, it's been a pretty dramatic start to the season by any measure. We've had some spectacular races. We've had a new first-time winner in Nico Rosberg, four different cars, four different drivers. What can you put the unpredictability of this early part of the season down to? Is there anything you can put your finger on?
Yeah, I think it's quite simple at the tyres. You know, the tyres are the same for everybody, but optimising the characteristics of those tyres is proving to be very tricky, and different circuits have flattered and suited different cars, but you know, we've been reasonably consistent over the first four races and managed to win in Bahrain, which you know, brought us back to Europe leading both championships, which was slightly unexpected, certainly after the first couple of races where McLaren had been so strong. So, you know, I think whoever gets on top of understanding these tyres, and at the end of the day they're the same for everybody, the quickest will ultimately prevail in this championship.
We've heard Michael Schumacher come out with some critical comments about Pirelli in the last couple of weeks. From your point of view, Christian, given that the technology and the manpower involved in the sport, do you think that the tyres are perhaps playing a slightly disproportionately important role to proceedings this year? Because you mentioned how critical it is to try and get on top of them. Some weeks some cars seem to be in the window, other weeks they seem to be miles out. Do you think they are perhaps having too much of an effect?
I think they're playing a crucial effect, but that's providing very, very good racing. And at the end of the day, they're the same for everyone. So that's the challenge. I think, you know, as a Formula One fan, the racing this year has been phenomenal so far in four examples. And, you know, the tyres are obviously a huge contributor to that as the different teams endeavour to understand and optimise them.
Christian, you mentioned before how Red Bull has come back to Europe leading both the drivers and constructors and being slightly surprised by that. You must have been thrilled with Sebastian Vettel's win in Bahrain. It was just a week before that that he hadn't even made Q3 in China. What do you think the turnaround in fortunes is down to, and how has Seb handled that based on previous years and how he's matured as a driver?
Well, firstly, I think he's handled it very well. You know, he's not given up. He's not let his head drop. And, you know, on the days you can't win, it's important to be picking up as many points as possible. And, you know, he drove a very good race in Australia. He was unfortunate in Malaysia. He drove a good race in China. And then, obviously, really turned up and delivered in Bahrain. So I think he's dealt with that, you know, well. And, you know, we've learned a lot about the car. We've been introducing components at each Grand Prix. We've been working the guys in the garage, you know, pretty hard, and they've delivered. And but, you know, we're only four races into a 20-race campaign.
There's obviously a heap of interest, Christian, in Mark Webber, as you can understand down here. He seems to have started this year on a better footing than he did in 2011. Perhaps there was a little bit of a near-miss hangover with the championship from 2010. How have you seen Mark's driving, and probably more importantly, his demeanour this year compared to last? Have you noticed much of a difference?
Yeah, there's a world of difference in Mark this year. He's more relaxed. He's enjoying, or he looks like he's enjoying, you know, driving within Formula One. And, you know, his performances have been very, very strong. You know, he's been very consistent. Four fourth places, you know, whilst frustrating, we haven't seen him on the podium yet. You know, it's all huge points. And, you know, he's currently third in the Drivers' Championship. He's in good shape. His confidence is high. And I think he can put together a very, very strong campaign this year. And I think he's, you know, he's better equipped to deal with it. And seems to be in a, you know, in a great place at the moment.
So you think he's more back sort of towards that 2010 spec? Mark Webber was, you know, feisty right up the front for the majority of the year, as opposed to last year, where from the beginning it didn't really seem to work out for him, did it?
I think he's in good shape. I think he's focused. He's hungry. You know, he seems comfortable within the team. The team obviously know him very, very well, and you know, he's determined to you know, put a really strong campaign together this year. So, you know, his work rate is second to none, and he's very, very focused on fighting for the championship this year.
Of course, Christian, Mark's not the only Australian we're keeping an eye on. I'm sure you've got half an eye on how Daniel Ricciardo's going in his first full season with Toro Rosso. He's up against a very, very quick teammate who a lot of Australians may not know that much about in Jean-Éric Vergne. From what you've been able to see of Daniel's first four races, how do you think he's adjusting to life in the second Red Bull team?
I think he's doing a good job. We know Daniel's quick. We push very hard. As a member of the Red Bull Junior team, he's a Red Bull racing driver that, you know, as Sebastian Vettel was on loan to Toro Rosso, as is Jean-Éric Vergne. And they're both very, very talented youngsters, both been given the opportunity, you know, in Formula One, which they perhaps wouldn't have otherwise had, had it not been for Red Bull's support and backing. And Daniel's, you know, doing a good job. He's showing a real turn of speed. His qualifying in Bahrain was phenomenal. You know, to put it sixth on the grid was a really fantastic lap in Q3 from him. Unfortunately, the start of the race didn't go his way. But, you know, he's going to have many more opportunities during the course of this year to demonstrate his talent and learn and continue to develop. And I think it's great for Australia to have, you know, two world-class drivers in Mark and the emergence of Daniel.
Well, we're certainly enjoying watching them down here. Christian, thanks very much for your time, and all the best of luck for Barcelona coming up.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's all we have time for this edition of Keeping Track. Don't forget to like the Australian Grand Prix on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at AusGrandPrix, or go to grandprix.com.au, where you'll find details of which big-name international guests are coming up on our next episode. Thanks to our guests Christian Horner and Will Buxton, and a special thanks to Katie Tweedle at Red Bull Racing for her wonderful help as always. Thanks for listening. Please join us again on Keeping Track soon.